Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated this Friday, March 30th, 2012. And as usual, we will begin by looking at the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Romney Widens the Gap. What happened? Mitt Romney solidified his lead in the race for the Republican presidential nomination this past week with two blowout victories in the Illinois and Puerto Rico primaries. In Illinois, Romney won 47% of the vote to Rick Santorum's 35% and netted 43 of the state's 54 delegates. He now has 563 delegates to Santorum's 263, making it virtually impossible, barring some major turn of events, for Santorum to catch up. The former Massachusetts governor is now almost halfway to obtaining the 1,144 delegates he needs to capture the Republican nomination. To finish the job, he must win 46% of the remaining delegates. Santorum would need 69%. In his victory speech, Romney ignored his Republican rivals and pivoted toward a showdown with Obama. "It's time to say this word, enough," he said. "We deserve a president who believes in us, and I believe in the American people." Romney's resounding Illinois victory brought a welcome endorsement of former Florida governor and Republican heavyweight Jeb Bush, who said it was time for the party to unite behind Romney. Santorum's campaign appeared to be in disarray with little funding or logistical support, but he promised to revive it with first-place finishes in this week's Louisiana primary and in his home state of Pennsylvania, which votes on April the 24th. Now here's what the editorials have to say. "Once again, Romney has proved he's the best man to take on Obama," said the Chicago Tribune. "His message, which is more attuned to economic rather than social issues, has made him the party's leading force in urban and suburban areas. And come November, it'll be voters in metropolitan communities, not the socially conservative small towns and rural areas that typically favor Santorum, that will deliver battleground states such as Ohio, Florida, and Virginia." "Romney might be leading the race," said the NationalReview.com, "but his progress has been painful and slow. He consistently does well among affluent and moderate conservatives, the majority of voters in Illinois. But Romney has lost every state where evangelicals make up 50% of the electorate, and he polls poorly among low- and middle-income voters. If he wins the nomination, having Obama on the ballot will help him win over some of those groups. But his trouble with blue-collar voters will not be so easily fixed." Now here's what the columnist said. "The end of this long and torturous race is finally in sight," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "The Pennsylvania primary will now present an opportunity for the surging Romney to close out his opponent by beating him in his home state. But even if Santorum wins Pennsylvania and some remaining southern states, his only remaining hope is to deny Romney the 1,144 delegates he needs and hope for the best at an open convention." "This isn't going to finish anytime soon," said Nate Silver in NYTimes.com. The delegate math shows that Romney has little chance of winning the nomination until May 29th when Texas votes, and it's more likely he won't reach the magic number until the June 5th primaries in California and New Jersey. He might even have to wait until the June 26th Utah primary. The only way it'll end sooner is if Santorum bows out, said Chris Saliza in the Washington Post. But the combative Santorum shows no inclination to call it quits. Most Republican office holders, meanwhile, are reluctant to pressure him to get out for the good of the party, out of fear of incurring the lasting enmity of the conservative Tea Party base. But the longer this campaign goes on, the more damage Romney suffers, says Andrew Romano in the DailyBeast.com. Since 1976, no serious contender, Democrat or Republican, has watched his approval ratings fall as low as Romney's have in recent months. The most recent poll found his unfavorable rating at 50%, with just 37.6% favorable. To beat Obama in November, Romney will have to make history, not simply by being one of the richest men elected president or the first Mormon, but by changing more minds that are more deeply set against him than any other nominee in recent history. The next item from the main story section of the week, the GOP's alternative path. House Republicans set the stage for a major philosophical collision with President Obama and the Democrats by introducing a budget this week that would cut spending by $5.3 trillion over the next decade, cut taxes across the board, and transform Medicare into a premium support program. The blueprint drawn up by House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, the Republican from Wisconsin, would overhaul the current tax code, leaving just two individual tax brackets of 10 and 25%. Ryan's plan would repeal the Affordable Care Act and reform Medicare by giving seniors a subsidy they could either spend on private health care or traditional Medicare coverage. It would reduce non-entitlement spending as a percentage of GDP from about 12.5% today to 5.75% by 2030, a rate not seen since World War II. The budget has no prospect of passing the Democratic-controlled Senate, but Ryan said Republicans wanted to offer voters an election year contrast to President Obama's budget plans. There is an alternative path to the one the president has us on, he said. Thank you, Paul Ryan, said Douglas Holtz Eakin in NationalReview.com. Finally, a budget resolution that reduces our deficit by $3 trillion, moves to a pro-growth tax plan, and tackles entitlement spending before it crushes us. Obama and the Democrats have pretended the deficit crisis doesn't exist, offering nothing but more spending and more tax increases. Republicans have shown real leadership with this strong statement of social, economic, and political values. The only value Republicans stand for, said Robert Reich in Salon.com, is letting the rich get richer and the poor go hang. Ryan's budget would slash Medicaid spending by a third and gut programs like food stamps, Pell Grants, and job training initiatives. While seniors paid more for health care and the poor suffered brutal cuts, the wealthiest Americans would get tax cuts of at least $150,000 a year. This is pure social Darwinism of the most heartless kind. Ryan's budget is more of a political statement than a governing blueprint, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. But while he's right that Congress needs to cut the deficit, highly partisan proposals aren't the way forward. Someday lawmakers will set the politicking aside and come up with a long-term fiscal plan that both parties can support. This isn't it. The next item, Obama launches campaign. President Obama kicked off his re-election campaign last week with a flurry of fundraising events and the release of a video outlining signature achievements of his presidency. Obama held 5 fundraisers in Chicago and Atlanta on a single day last week, while Vice President Joe Biden attacked the president's Republican challengers at a campaign-style event in Ohio. If you give any one of them the keys to the White House, they will bankrupt the middle class again, he said. The re-election campaign 17-minute video, The Road We've Traveled, highlights actions Obama has taken to address the financial crisis, particularly the auto bailout and the stimulus bill. Let's remember how far we've come, says the movie's narrator, Tom Hanks, and look forward to the work still to be done. Forget all that hopey, changey stuff, said William Salatin in Slate.com. In The Road We've Traveled, members of the Obama administration line up to remind you in somber tones just how bad things were in early 2009, when the economy was in meltdown. The clear message of the re-election campaign is that Obama's gutsy actions have turned things around. Things were bad. They're better now. Be grateful. It could have been worse as a pretty weak re-election pitch, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. Anyone can see that things aren't better now. We're still saddled with an entitlement crisis, high unemployment, and a crippling deficit. Obama's tenure has been, by any reasonable standard, a failure. Not even a Tom Hanks-narrated documentary can change that. Obama did help repair the country's fortunes, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but his reality-based campaign has been disappointing so far. Americans want a sweeping, optimistic vision of America's future, not a tutorial on the terrible 4 years we've lived through. Obama can't bank on the Republicans continuing to run an even lousier campaign. He'd better give voters a reason to get out of bed on election day. Now, from the main story section of the Week magazine, let's take a look at the controversy of the week. It's entitled, Gas Prices, Will More Drilling Bring Them Down? Gas hit $4 a gallon in some parts of the country this past week, said Henry Payne in NationalReview.com, and it's the president's fault. That may seem a rather simplistic charge, given the complexity of the global oil market, but it's the same one the Democratic Party used against President Bush when gas hit the $4 mark in May of 2008. And since President Obama is the most anti-carbon president in U.S. history, blaming him for soaring gas prices actually has some merit. This is, after all, a president who went on record supporting higher gas prices as a way of curbing global warming, and who has consistently aligned himself with green extremists in blocking the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada and efforts to drill for new sources of oil here in the U.S. Many Americans agree that Obama is to blame, said Major Garrett in NationalJournal.com. Some polls show Obama's approval rating plunging by 5 to 10 points in recent weeks. Not surprisingly, the Republican candidates vying to replace him have jumped on the issue, with Newt Gingrich promising $2.50 a gallon gas if elected. Make no mistake, the rising price of gasoline could cost Obama the presidency. It's ridiculous to think that presidents control gas prices, said Robert Semple in the New York Times. As Republicans were quick to point out when gas prices spiked to $4 a gallon under President Bush, the cost of a barrel of oil is determined by global, not domestic, commodities markets. Prices are high at the moment because of the ongoing surge in demand from the developing world, particularly China and India. A looming European embargo on Iranian oil and the threat of war with Iran, which could seriously disrupt oil shipping through the Straits of Hormuz. During Obama's presidency, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, domestic oil production actually increased by 13%, while imported oil dropped to 45% of total consumption, down from 60% in 2005. But the facts don't matter to Republicans, who are desperate for an issue to run on now that the economic recovery is gaining strength. Yes, of course, presidents have no direct control over gas prices, says Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post also. But the pain at the pump is helping focus the voters' attention on Obama's rigid, fatuous, fantasy-driven energy policy. He continues to block drilling off the mid-Atlantic coast, off Florida in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and on federal lands in the Rockies, while wasting taxpayer dollars promoting solar boondoggles like Solyndra and a laughable project to get energy out of algae. Obama thinks fossil fuels are evil and outdated, and is thus utterly unserious about the real world of oil in which the rest of us live. Sorry to spoil your argument, said Michael Clare in MotherJones.com, but in the real world of oil, prices are headed up, regardless of who's in the White House. The demand from China and India is only going to grow in coming years, and as the former CEO of Chevron put it, the era of easy oil is over. The planet still has huge reserves of petroleum, but they're miles under the sea, in the Arctic, buried in shale or tar sands and in other hard-to-reach locations. Extracting it will be environmentally destructive, accelerate global warming, and cost a lot of money. Oil companies will pass that cost on to consumers. No matter how much drilling occurs in the U.S., high gas prices are here to stay. Now, from the controversy of the week, we will turn to the popular column Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 in the Week magazine for this week. It was a good week for common sense. After the TSA said it would begin testing less stringent screening procedures for passengers who are 75 and older, allowing them to keep their shoes on and avoid body pat-downs. We know people in that population and age group pose a lower risk to security, said a TSA spokesman. It was a good week for not needing the airlines after Dutch engineer Jarno Smeets flew for 1 minute by flapping custom-made bird wings that also had a power assist. You see the ground moving away and then suddenly you're free, Smeets said on a video of his feet. Effing magical, he said. It was a good week for getting snipped after Urology Associates of Cape Cod began airing a TV commercial offering a free pizza to any man who has a vasectomy. A free pizza topping is also included, by the way. And it was a bad week for situational awareness after 45-year-old Bonnie Miller of Benton Harbor, Michigan, fell off a pier into Lake Michigan while texting. She had to be rescued by a passerby who dove in the water and police using a rope tied to a life preserver. It was a bad week for vanity plates after a Canadian woman pleaded guilty to trying to transport 24 pounds of cocaine in an SUV with a license plate Smuggler while checked into the Smuggler's Inn. And it was a bad week for thinking you're Tom Jones after Jeffrey Lee Thompson, 28, began stripping while performing at karaoke night at an Applebee's restaurant in Melbourne, Florida, and allegedly punched a manager who tried to stop him. He was intoxicated, a police spokesman said, and he became very involved with his performance. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the People section. Our first item here is entitled Maddow's Unwanted Outing. Rachel Maddow still regrets the way she came out as a lesbian, said Lloyd Grove in Newsweek. I was a freshman at Stanford University and had just figured out I was gay, says the MSNBC host. There was nobody else out in my class of more than 1,000 people, which was kind of crazy. So together with a friend who was coming out at the same time, Maddow gave an interview to the student newspaper about being the only two gay freshmen on campus. The mistake I made was that I had not come out to my parents. Maddow asked the paper to hold off publishing the piece until after the weekend so she could go home and tell her mom and dad she was gay. They ran it before the weekend, and some anonymous person mailed it to my parents. Her Catholic parents were shocked and upset. First, they were having to deal with the fact that I was gay. Second, that I'm gay in the newspaper. And third, that they've raised a horrific rugrat who would tell the newspaper before her family. Maddow's parents are wonderful now and couldn't be more supportive, but she still hasn't forgotten herself for how she handled her public coming out. More than 20 years later, I feel acutely angry for having put myself in that position. The next item, the celebrity tattooist who said no. Scott Campbell has tattooed Sting's back and Helena Christensen's ankle, said Jesse Ashlock in details. But there's one body part the celebrity tattooist refuses to ink. There was this 19-year-old girl who came to my studio with her friend. I was like, okay, what are we doing, he says. The girl pulled out a piece of paper with a large W on it, the logo of rap group the Wu-Tang Clan. I was like, so where are we putting this? She pointed at her cheek. I said, no, absolutely not. And she was like, such and such a tattoo shop will do it. My friend got it. Her friend then turned and showed Campbell the W on her face. It just broke my heart. I immediately picked up the phone and started screaming at that other tattoo shop. You just ruined a girl's life for $80. Campbell realizes he sounds like a hypocrite. I have tons of terrible tattoos on me. It's just a mishmash of God knows how many drunken evenings. But facial tattoos are dangerous, he says. I can still button up and put on my normal guy costume when I want. Once you have a tattoo on your face, people don't remember your name. You're just that guy with a tattoo on his face. And the next item, Welsh's porn fatigue. Raquel Welsh thinks that the internet porn has ruined America's men, said Eric Spitznagel in Men's Health magazine. It's an exploitation of the poor male's libido, says the 71-year-old actress. Poor babies, they can't control themselves. I just imagine them sitting in front of their computers completely annihilated. They haven't done anything. They don't have a job. They barely have any ambition anymore. This addiction to online erotica, Welsh says, has damaged men's ability to relate to real women. It makes for laziness and a not very good sex partner. Do they know how to negotiate something that isn't prefab and injected directly into their brains? Welsh is aware that some people might accuse her of becoming a prude in her old age. I don't care if I'm becoming one of those old fogies who says, back in my day, we didn't have to hear about sex all the time, she says. Nobody remembers what it's like to be left to form your own ideas about what's erotic and sexual. I thought that was the fun of the whole thing. It's my fantasy. I didn't pick it up off the internet somewhere. And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine for this week, March 30th, 2012. Thanks for joining me today. Now, we'll continue on with our reading of The Weekly Briefing. This week, it's entitled, An Epidemic Spread by Sight. More than a dozen teenage girls in upstate New York are suffering from inexplicable tics. Is it all in their minds? How did this outbreak start? In October, several cheerleaders at a high school in Leroy, a town of 7,600 people in western New York, began exhibiting unexplained symptoms similar to those of Tourette's syndrome, facial spasms, involuntary arm swings, stuttering, and sudden verbal outbursts. The ranks of sufferers soon swelled to at least 16 girls, along with a teenage boy and a 36-year-old woman. At first, the cases baffled doctors and caused frightened speculation among parents who blamed rare strep infections, side effects from a vaccine against the human papilloma virus and toxins left by a chemical spill nearly 4 decades ago. Environmental activist Aaron Brockovich was even called in to investigate, but tests have so far ruled out all environmental and infectious causes. The leading theory now is that the girls suffer from what is known as a conversion disorder. What is conversion disorder? Well, it's a psychological phenomenon in which people convert stress or emotional trauma into physical symptoms, sometimes in response to witnessing those symptoms in others. The disorder remains poorly understood, but the symptoms are very real and can appear suddenly in otherwise healthy people. Experts say it is a matter of the brain making the body sick, as it does when stage fright causes nausea or breathing problems. When multiple people are affected, experts refer to it as mass psychogenic illness, or what used to be known as mass hysteria, a term that has fallen out of favor because of its sexist connotations. These outbreaks, which typically affect girls more than boys, are believed to spread from person to person via unconscious social mimicry of other people, just as watching someone yawn can cause others to do so involuntarily. The girls in Leroy come from a small community, said Dr. Laszlo Mechler, who is treating some of them. One may have had a significant symptom, and it was like a wildfire. Do such outbreaks happen often? More often than people realize. In 2007, more than a dozen girls in a Florida high school developed unexplained wheezing that lasted weeks. The same girls, 600 girls at a Catholic, the same year rather, 600 girls at a Catholic boarding school in Mexico experienced mysterious fevers and buckling knees. In 2010, at least 15 students at two all-girls schools in Brunei began screaming and shaking uncontrollably. Outbreaks have been recorded not just in schools, but also in workplaces over the past few centuries. In 1789, a female worker in an English textile factory put a mouse down the dress of a skittish co-worker who began to convulse. Workers began to whisper that imported cotton had caused the reaction, and the factory had to be shut down after 24 other workers suffered similar convulsions. More recently, in 1977, dozens of female workers at a West Virginia shoe factory fainted on the job. They said they were overcome with toxic fumes, but federal investigators diagnosed them with assembly line hysteria. Similar outbreaks occurred in convents during the Middle Ages. Why are girls more susceptible to this? Well, there are several possible reasons. Girls are socialized to suppress stress rather than act out aggressively, causing it to manifest in otherwise unexplained physical symptoms. During adolescence, girls also have an acute desire to belong to a group, which can add to their stress and make them especially attentive to social cues. Teenage girls are very susceptible to drama and each other's moods, says clinical psychologist Nancy Molitor. And women are more likely to seek medical treatment than men, which may skew the numbers involved in mass outbreaks. Were the girls in Leroy under stress? The girls have repeatedly claimed that they were normal, happy teenagers before their symptoms appeared. But Dr. Jennifer McVeig, a local pediatric neurologist, says that all 10 of the girls she saw had something big that happened in their lives prior to the outbreak, whether it was a divorce, a sick parent, abuse, or other emotionally upsetting event. It has also emerged that 3 of the girls suffered from tic disorders prior to the outbreak, which doctors say could have unconsciously influenced the other patients. Those who came down with symptoms posted videos of themselves twitching on Facebook, which other girls viewed before developing the same symptoms themselves. Nonetheless, several of the girls' parents and many other people in the Leroy community are skeptical about the diagnosis of conversion disorder and have called for more tests aimed at finding possible environmental and medical factors. Are they getting better? Reports indicate that they are. Symptoms have disappeared altogether for several girls, and others are being treated with a combination of anti-anxiety drugs, cognitive behavioral therapy, and counseling. Doctors report that their conditions have steadily improved, particularly after videos of the girls twitching were removed from TV stations' websites and social media. These girls will get better, says Meckler. We have to give them time and space. And the footnote to this briefing article, the susceptibility of cheerleaders. It hasn't escaped researchers' notice that cheerleaders are often figure in cases of mass psychogenic outbreaks. Four of the first girls to exhibit symptoms in Leroy were on the cheerleading squad. In 2002, 10 girls began suffering unexplained seizures at a school in rural North Carolina. Half were cheerleaders. And in 1952, scores of members of a Louisiana cheerleading squad mysteriously fainted in quick succession at a football game. Experts theorize that because cheerleaders are considered popular, outbreaks are more likely to begin with them than with classmates of lower status. There's also a theory that cohesive groups, particularly those that wear matching uniforms and excel at synchronized movements, might be more susceptible to mass suggestion. But that's as close as social psychologists have gotten to figure out why, as social critic Caitlin Flanagan recently wrote, it is the cheerleaders and not the linebackers who come down with tics and stuttering. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll take a look at the best columns in the U.S. for this week. Our first one is entitled Killed for the Crime of Being Black by Leonard Pitts, Jr. in the Miami Herald. Every African American knows what it's like to feel invisible, said Leonard Pitts, Jr. The death of teenager Trayvon Martin last month is yet more proof that invisibility plagues black folks still. The 17-year-old was walking from a snack run to a 7-Eleven back to his father's home in a gated community in a suburb of Orlando when he was spotted by George Zimmerman, captain of a neighborhood watch group. Zimmerman, who is white, called the cops to say he had spotted a suspicious character. A few minutes later, Martin was dead from a gunshot wound to the chest. Zimmerman says he acted in self-defense and has not been charged with a crime. But what made him decide that Martin, a kid carrying only a bag of Skittles and a lemonade, seemed auspicious? He was black. And when you're black, white people often don't see you. They look right through you at the dark and scary face that lurks at the open windows of their vivid imaginations. So now Trayvon Martin is dead, visible too late. The next column is entitled America's Real War on Women by Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. There really is a war against women, said Peggy Noonan, but it is not, as the White House would have you believe, a war waged by Republicans to curtail women's rights to contraceptives. In recent years, it has become acceptable on both the left and the right to attack women in public life with demeaning sexual slurs that are wholly based on the fact that they are women. So it was that Rush Limbaugh thought nothing of attacking an advocate of contraceptive coverage as a slut. Liberals, the Rolling Stones' Matt Taibbi or comedian Bill Mayer, meanwhile think they have a pass to attack prominent conservative women in the vilest possible terms, including publicly describing them in the Imagine Acts of Fellatio. How did we get to such a low place? The Internet clearly has played a major role in the coarsening of discourse in public life, enabling anonymous jerks in basements to let loose with torrents of obscene rage with powerful women a frequent target. The rules have changed and the unrestrained ID rules. So let no one pretend that misogyny is limited to conservatives or liberals. It's time for men to clean up their act. And the next article here, the next column, is entitled Scaring People Away from Smoking by Kent Sepkowitz in the DailyBeast.com. Can terror and disgust compel people to stop smoking? Asked Kent Sepkowitz. It sure can. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention just unveiled a new $54 million scare campaign aimed at curbing smoking, the nation's leading cause of disease and preventable death. In graphic TV, radio, and print ads, former smokers display the consequences of tobacco's toll on their bodies, amputated toes and legs, paralysis, the throat holes through which they must now breathe, the teeth and hair lost to cancer treatments. The ads make any viewer squirm, especially smokers, leading some critics to argue that viewers will simply click off and reach for their cigarettes. But multiple scientific studies have found that the scarier the message, the more it burrows into the viewer's brains, and the more likely it is to change their behavior. Big Tobacco has spent decades using the likes of Humphrey Bogart, the Marlboro Man, and Joe Camel to convince people that smoking is cool. Now the CDC has set out to beat cigarette companies at their own game. To save tens of thousands of lives, a little disgust is a small price to pay. And now we will flip to the back of the week magazine for the last word. The title of this week's edition of the last word is A Survivor's Tale. Peter Moore endured 947 days of torture by Shiite terrorists, says Hampton Sides, and he lived to tell about it. During his captivity, Peter Moore vowed to himself that if the end ever came, he wouldn't grovel or beg. He would stay calm in the face of death. He would fixate on a happy memory of when he was a boy in England walking the family dog. One day, in the summer of 2007, somewhere in the sun-bleached warrens of the Iraqi city of Basra, the end seemed finally to have arrived. A guard blindfolded Peter, cuffed his hands behind his back, took him outside, and shoved him to the ground. He felt the cool metal of a pistol pressed to his head, heard tense conversation in Arabic. He broke out in a sweat and began to shake. As he knelt in that nameless alley, Peter was sure he was going to die. The gun barrel dug into his scalp. He heard a click and felt a pop against his skull. So this is what it's like to be dead, he thought. It's not so bad. It doesn't hurt much. For a few moments, he remained kneeling in the dirt, waiting for his body to rise into the spirit world. But then he heard laughter, more voices speaking in Arabic. Finally, he realized that this was just a grim hoax designed to shatter his psyche, a mock execution. He fell to the ground, shivering, anguished, and spent. He was less frightened than he was annoyed at himself. He'd forgotten his vow not to show fear. I was supposed to think about walking the dog. But as Peter returned to his darkened room in the upstairs of some unknown house in Basra, he was more adamant than ever that he would make it out of Iraq alive. Peter Moore is a shambling bear of a man with a booming laugh and a ready smile of crowded teeth. A 38-year-old bachelor, he hails from Lincoln, an ancient cathedral city in the East Midlands region of England. His background is normal enough: Boy Scouts, college, a master's in computer science. He's a mild-mannered type who fidgets with his iPhone like anyone else. But make no mistake, here is a man with resilience. Peter's job as an international IT consultant brought him to Baghdad in the spring of 2007. On May 29, 2007, he was kidnapped by a group of some 40 Iranian-financed Shiite militiamen who call themselves Ashab al-Ahaq, the League of Righteousness. Four British bodyguards who were assigned to protect Peter were quickly overpowered, abducted along with him, and eventually killed. Videos on YouTube showed a resolute, raccoon-eyed Peter Moore pleading with British and U.S. authorities to answer his captors' demands. All told, Peter Moore was held for 947 days. Then on the morning of December 30th, 2009, Peter's guards stuffed him in the rear of a car, drove him blindfolded across Baghdad, and released him to the British embassy. Disheveled, sallow, and disoriented, Peter was so overcome with emotion that he couldn't face the ecstatic embassy staffers who greeted him. He went straight to the bathroom and stood for a long time looking at himself in a wall of mirrors, incredulous at his own good fortune. "I just put my hands on the wall and told myself, 'You've done it. You beat the odds. You made it out.'" More than 2 years later, Peter still doesn't precisely understand how he beat those odds. Figuratively speaking, he's still studying his face in the mirror, trying to find meaning in a harrowing and surreal experience. He has since returned to international IT work as a post in Guyana, but Iraq is never far from his mind. "It still feels strange," he says. "I feel like I've lost years that I have to catch up on. I've tried to get on with my life, but I have to say, it was an incomparable feeling to wake up in the morning and think, 'Is this going to be the last day that I live?' And to think that every single morning for 2.5 years." Though he has been praised as a hero, Peter is more inclined to point to the element of luck than to anything that he did correctly or courageously during his activity. As far as he's concerned, the four now-deceased British bodyguards who were kidnapped were the true heroes. "Really and truthfully," he says, I feel that whether you live or die in these hostage situations has more to do with the toss of a coin than any sort of practical things that you do." Still, in his own unassuming, cerebral way, Peter escaped the negative behaviors that psychologists point to as the common pitfalls of the hostage experience. Luck was on his side, to be sure, but going purely on instinct and common sense, he seems to have done nearly everything right, both during his captivity and in its aftermath. From the outset, it's common for hostages to blame themselves for their predicament. "If only I hadn't gone down that alley," they'll think. If only I hadn't been so stupid." Men will sometimes show a certain shame and guilt, says Melanie Hetzel Riggin, an associate professor of psychology at Western Illinois University. They'll say, "I should have been more of a man and acted accordingly." Except for that moment after the mock execution, Peter seems to have avoided this line of thinking. "At first I thought I would do a MacGyver and break my way out," he says. "You know, I'll use a paperclip and a bottle of water to escape. I'll grab him by the throat. I'll bite his ear off. I'll kung fu kick the guy." But it doesn't work like that. Only in Hollywood does Indiana Jones win. The reality is, we never had a chance to escape. Instead, Peter endured. For months, he was beaten, subjected to psychological torture, interrogated, and humiliated. The cruelty seemed to come in random gusts. One guard would beat him for standing, and then another would come along 10 minutes later and beat him for sitting. Once a guard cuffed his hands behind his back and then ordered him to stand on a chair and hang his arms over the top of an open door. Another guard pulled his arms down while a third guard kicked the chair out from under him, leaving Peter to dangle awkwardly over the door until he finally fell to the floor in agony. They repeated this 3 times. Despite the torment he endured, Peter concentrated on small ways he could connect with his captors. He listened sympathetically when they explained their hatred of the American occupation of Iraq. To appeal to his captors' professed respect for family, he invented a spouse. "I've never been married," Peter says, "but I felt I had to come up with a wife. That's what they wanted to hear." Because his guards seemed to value religion, any religion, over atheism, he claimed he was a devout Roman Catholic and started to pray. "I actually found it quite relaxing," Peter says. "If nothing else, it felt like I was complaining to someone about the day." His guards found his religious zeal so convincing that they brought him prayer beads and seemed pleased to see that he used them every day for the rest of his captivity. Peter had several recurring fantasies that kept him sane, especially during the first 12 months when he lived shackled to a wall grate, blindfolded and handcuffed. For example, he would often find himself at an imaginary motorcycle shop trying to decide among a brand new Harley-Davidson, a Ducati, or a BMW. In his mind, he would linger over the bikes, running his hand over every contour, lavishing his attention on every tailpipe, saddlebag, and pin-striping detail. But he never lost touch with the reality of his situation. Near the end of his first year of captivity, Peter took stock and decided to push back. His guards kept insisting that he was a military operative and not a civilian contractor. One day, following their line of reasoning, Peter said, "If you want to keep me as a prisoner of war, fine, but I want to be kept as a prisoner of war, not an animal. Look at the way you're treating me. You've kept me in chains for over a year. I am a human being." Something he said resonated with his guards. Immediately, the chains came off for an hour a day. Over the next year, his treatment steadily improved. By that point, however, the months of uncertainty and terror had already done their damage. The trauma of the beatings, and particularly the mock execution, seared itself into Peter's psyche. He has suffered from nightmares, loss of appetite, and vivid flashbacks. Sometimes he'll be at work, and suddenly the adrenaline will start flowing. He is actively reliving something one of his guards did to him. "It's a bit embarrassing," he says, "because someone will come over and say, 'You okay?' And I'll say, 'Yeah.' But I can just feel my heart going doof, doof, doof." Other times in his bedroom in Guyana, Peter will be drifting off to sleep to the screech of the tropical bugs when he'll suddenly jerk himself awake, thinking he's still shackled to that walled grate in Iraq. He'll look down and realize it's just the mosquito net wrapped around his foot. While PTSD is a very real possibility for Peter, as it is for all kidnapping victims, the research is also increasingly peppered with references to something called post-traumatic benefits. I've talked with hostages who have declared that the experience was in some ways beneficial, says psychologist James Campbell, the author of Hostage, Terror, and Triumph. After this, they'll say, "It got me rethinking things. Life is finite. Let's not waste it. Am I living it the way I should be?" Frank Uchtberg, professor of psychiatry at Michigan State University, notes that some individuals come out of their captivity experiences feeling wiser. They say, "I'm going to shift my priorities. I'm going to spend more time with people I enjoy and love." This has certainly been true for Peter. Nowadays, he works less, travels more, spends more time with his friends. He stopped drinking, exercises more, eats healthier. He calls his captivity a test of faith and an interesting life experience, but not one I want to repeat. Peter is quite aware that he lives in an unstable country where kidnapping, though uncommon, is a possibility. He's decided that he can't let what happened in Iraq rob him of his career or rule his life. "I'm not going to do anything stupid," he says. "I'm not going to any more war zones. But who knows? Iraq might be a perfectly nice place to go on holiday in 20 years' time." For now, however, Peter is sticking with a safer vacation destination. Next year, he's planning to do something he's dreamed of most of his life, take a motorcycle trip across America. He's still mulling what to buy for the journey. Harley-Davidson? BMW? He's looking forward to spending some quality time in a bike shop, trying to decide. And that was from a Men's Health article, Hostage by Hampton Sides, copyrighted 2011 by Hampton Sides and reprinted with permission. You are listening to our reading of the week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the week magazine. And our first article is entitled, "Afghanistan, What Made Sergeant Bales Snap?" It was an end no one saw coming, said Douglas Belkin in the Wall Street Journal. Longtime friends and colleagues of 38-year-old Robert Bales knew him as an outgoing and trustworthy soldier, a devoted husband, and a loving father of two, who joined the Army after 9/11 out of a new sense of duty to his country. In three grueling tours of duty in Iraq, Staff Sergeant Bales carved out a reputation as an exemplary soldier who kept cool under fire. But last week, while on a fourth tour of duty, this time to Afghanistan, Bales snapped. In pre-dawn darkness, he crept away from his military base in Panjwai, walked to a small village, and allegedly slaughtered 16 Afghan civilians, nine of them children, shooting and stabbing them in their beds before setting fire to some of their bodies. We don't yet know for sure what triggered Bales' rampage, said James Dow in the New York Times, but military officials said Bales' mind had buckled under the combined stresses of repeated tours of duty, financial and marital problems, and alcohol. His lawyer, meanwhile, is blaming a traumatic brain injury suffered in Iraq. That's not our Bobby, said Michelle Cattle, who grew up with Bales in Norwood, Ohio. Something horrible, horrible had to happen to him. The phenomenon of soldier snapping is as old as combat itself, said Brad Knickerbocker in CSMonitor.com. Witnessing fellow soldiers, civilians, and even the enemy being killed and dismembered takes a terrible psychic toll. Just a day before his rampage, Bales had seen a fellow soldier's leg blown off by a landmine. Bales himself had lost part of his foot during a previous tour in Iraq, said Matthew DeLuca in TheDailyBeast.com, and he suffered a brain injury when an improvised explosive device blew up under his Jeep and the vehicle rolled over on him. After nearly a decade of sending hundreds of thousands of young men and women into foreign combat, America is just beginning to confront the reality that war leaves no soldier untouched. Actually, Bales had problems before he ever set foot on a battlefield, said Bill Whitaker in CBSNews.com. In 2002, he was ordered to take anger management classes after he allegedly assaulted a woman. He was later cited for a hit-and-run car accident. And Bales' financial problems were much bigger than his legal issues. He still has a judgment of more than $1 million against him for stealing money from clients in his former career as a financial advisor, had defaulted on a mortgage, and was recently trying to sell a house he could no longer afford. The Army passed him over for a promotion and pay raise last year, a snub that his wife, Carolyn, wrote on her blog, had left him sad and disappointed. How easy it would be to blame this atrocity on some oblivious, or rather some obvious, defect of character, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times. But even if Bales had problems, as most of us do, he was hardly a psychopath when he joined the military. A colleague of his, Captain Chris Alexander, has asked people to pray for Bales, calling him one of the best guys I ever served with. What does that tell us? Since 9/11, our nation has chosen to fight two long wars on hostile foreign soil, and because we rely on an all-volunteer army, the burden of battle has fallen mainly on a tiny number of Americans, men like Sergeant Bales. We cope with our guilt by putting these professional soldiers on pedestals and calling them heroes. Then we send them on multiple journeys into the hell of war, from which some cannot come back. Don't blame the politicians alone. The blame can be shared from coast to coast by those of us who sacrifice nothing while people like Bales are being pushed to sacrifice far too much. Most of us who serve do not become homicidal monsters, said former Marine Benjamin Bush in TheDailyBeast.com. Indeed, what is truly surprising is how rarely these acts of madness occur, and how powerfully most veterans preserve their humanity. In Iraq, the Marines I commanded and I took great pains and endangered our own lives to avoid putting civilians in the crossfire. Yet even now I am haunted by the death and suffering I had a hand in delivering, and that it is as it should be. When he allegedly slaughtered sleeping children in their beds, Bobby Bales, small-town football player, warm and outgoing friend, father and husband, wore an American flag on his shoulder. The blood he spilled stains all of us because we sent him there. The next item here is Rutgers trial, when a prank becomes a crime. In prison, Darun Ravi will learn what it's like to live without privacy, said Andrea Pizer in the New York Post. The former Rutgers University student, 20 years old, was found guilty last week of violation of privacy and anti-gay intimidation, a hate crime in New Jersey, for using a webcam to spy on his roommate, making out with another man. Ravi sent out derisive Twitter messages describing his roommate, Tyler Clemente, kissing a dude and invited other students to watch the next encounter. After realizing that Ravi was outing him, Clemente, a quiet and shy 18-year-old, jumped to his death from the George Washington Bridge. Ravi now faces up to 10 years in jail and deportation to his native India, a suitable punishment for turning Clemente's short life into a peep show spectacle. This seminal verdict could help save other Clementes from online torture, said the Camden, New Jersey Courier Post in an editorial. Maybe now other young people will realize just how dangerous it is to use digital technology and social media to degrade and shame their peers. As we reach the end of our program, a few shorter items here. Every one penny rise in the cost of a gallon of gas takes $1 billion of consumer spending away from other goods in the course of a year, according to analysis by Credit Suisse Bank. A 50-cent increase this year would thus divert $50 billion away from consumer spending. In a majority of U.S. metropolitan areas, single childless women in their 20s generally have more education and higher median incomes than their male peers. In Dallas and Atlanta, the average young woman earns $1.18 and $1.14 respectively for every dollar earned by a male. And despite his frequent criticism of Bush administration policies, Mitt Romney has named 16 members of that administration to his team of 24 special advisors on national security and foreign policy. Bush loyalists all want to be back in power again, said former Bush speechwriter Matt Latimer, and Romney is the best bet. Now, from our poll watch for this week, 36% of likely voters say the Army sergeant accused of killing Afghan civilians should receive a death sentence if convicted. 48% say a death sentence should not be imposed. And 65% of Americans favor tighter government regulation of the natural gas drilling technique called fracking. 18% would like to see fewer restrictions. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.